Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you all to this final Faith and Business Luncheon of the academic year. My name is Connie Nelson. I'm Director of Public Affairs and Alumni Relations here at Perkins School of Theology. We have an outstanding program today. We have two speakers, and I know that you're looking forward to hearing them as much as I am. I'd like to introduce them both. One will speak immediately following the other. I'll introduce them both, and then we can welcome them with applause. Our first speaker is Rosalind Dawson Thompson, who joined the Dallas Women's Foundation as president and CEO in 2011. With experience in both local and national philanthropy, she moved from owning a national marketing communications firm and volunteering in the community to leading Dallas Women's Foundation, where she had been a passionate volunteer and donor for more than 25 years. Dallas Women's Foundation is the largest regional women's fund of the 160 women's funds worldwide. Over its 29-year history, the foundation has earned recognition as an innovator in the women's philanthropy movement and as a strong regional and national voice around critical issues that impact women and girls. The foundation annually grants more than $2.5 million to female-focused nonprofit programs and initiatives. Under Rosalind's leadership, Dallas Women's Foundation is expanding its impact and unlocking greater resources for women and girls to drive social and economic change in North Texas and beyond. A recipient of the Mora Women Helping Women Award for her contributions to improving the lives of women and girls, Rosalind has served as a volunteer board leader for numerous community organizations. Our second speaker this morning will be Dr. Rebecca Miles, who is professor of ethics and practical theology at Perkins School of Theology. She earned her PhD from the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, her Master of Divinity degree from the Iliff School of Theology, and a BA from Hendricks College. She also studied at the Eberhard Karl University in Tübingen, Germany. Rebecca is an active Methodist, a very active Methodist, and academic, and serves on many committees and boards, not only at SMU, but also across the country and, in fact, around the world. She is in demand as a lecturer, and her published articles are too numerous to name. She has authored several books, the most recent being When the One You Love Is Gone, which was published in 2012. Her service to the United Methodist Church includes active participation in national and world Methodist organizations. She was a member of the General Board of Church and Society and of the National Genetic Science Task Force, as well as a delegate and group leader at the General Conference. Rebecca is an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church and is a member of the Little Rock Annual Conference. Will you please join me in welcoming Rosalind Dawson Thompson and Rebecca Miles.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the privilege of being here today. Very much appreciate the Perkins School, Dean Lawrence, Associate Dean Parker, Reverend Nelson, Miss Dorothy, my buddy, and all of you for having me here today. And I want a special thanks to Dodie Crockett for believing that I have something to say. And thank you, Dodie, for having me here today. I also know that I got the best partner in the whole school. I know no prejudice here, but Dr. Rebecca Miles is a rock star, and I'm very fortunate to be partnered with her. One of my favorite sayings is Eleanor Roosevelt's, "Do something every day that scares you. This counts." I have, in my career, written speeches for executives all over the country. I have emceed events and given talks about organizations I was involved in. I was even a radio announcer at one point, I admit that. But I have never spoken in public about myself. And so I had to hand it to Rebecca, my partner, because she said, "Listen, look at it this way. Name and frame this thing as a spiritual autobiography. And just tell your story in that kind of way. So it made it a little less terrifying, not entirely less terrifying, but a little less terrifying, because it forced me to look at remembering and acknowledging events, inspirations, circumstances that caused me to make conscious choices. And so Rebecca and I both are asking you to listen to what we have to say today with that kind of filter in mind, that if this is a story of a spiritual autobiography, then perhaps you can be in the business also of writing your own. So to explain kind of spirituality in my own terms, I really will start with a definition of faith as a very strong belief in a set of principles and an allegiance to duty. And I want to give you a kind of view of the influences that have shaped my values, my sense of duty, and I'm going to borrow from a well-known and well-loved children's author. And it is Peter Reynolds, who was a guy that wrote a wonderful book for children called The North Star. Have any of you ever read it or had a child that has read it? If you have not, get the book. It's wonderful. And the device that he uses is to have the child imagine her constellation. What are the people, ideas, concepts that have illuminated the stars that kind of illuminate her path? And I really resonated to that and thought that would be a way for me to kind of explain my constellation and where these values I hope to live by come from. So first I'll give you my granddad. And the Reverend Joseph Martin Dawson. He was born in 1879 as one of 13 kids on a hardscrabble farm in Italy, Texas. And I do say that right. And he was the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Waco, Texas for 32 years. And then was in Washington representing the Baptists. But the thing that was very distinguishing about my granddad at that time is he was one of the first Texas Baptist ministers who ever addressed social issues from the pulpit. So my granddad spoke sermons on child labor, exploitation of immigrants, racial prejudice, and women's rights. So he was a really remarkable activist in his own right, and he also championed religious liberty and wrote 12 books on the separation of church and state, as well as Baptist history and an autobiography of Jose Antonio Navarro, and he also wrote a spiritual autobiography, A Thousand Months to Remember, of his time as a minister. Now, from him I learned intellectual curiosity. I learned a dedication to righting social wrongs, and he was an avid fisherman, so I also learned something else. I learned that it is a true fact that the longer you are away from the time you caught the fish increases in size and weight proportionally. So, you know, he really was a good storyteller. The next guy in my constellation is my dad, and my dad, Joe Dawson, was a war hero. He was a wildcatter geologist, an entrepreneur, an art collector, and a horseman. And in 1941, at 27, which was kind of old at that point to join World War II, my dad jumped on board, joined the Army, and he said he was called to service. And he served with honor. And my dad was recognized as the guy who broke open Omaha Beach on D-Day. He was much decorated, written about in numerous history books. Quick little aside, the way my sister and I found out about that, do you remember Landmark books? They were little history books for kids. We were like in second and third grade. We go to the bookstore with my mom, and you open up this book about D-Day, and it says, Dawson's Good Throw. It's like, that's our dad. when you'd ask him about being a war hero, he invariably said, I'm not a hero. The real heroes were the guys that I fought with and the guys that trusted me to lead them. I'll come back to that. The guys that trusted me to lead them. From Dad, I learned about devotion to duty, honor, and family, living with passion and curiosity, and that success is never owned by a single person. I also learned a lot about the upsides and downsides of risk-taking since he was in the oil business and the horse business, We did have ups and downs. Next in my constellation is my mother. And my mother, Melba, was a proud ship, an epitome of grace and an epitome of compassion. Mother had a lot of hardships early in life, things that kept her from realizing her early dreams, like going to college wasn't possible. She had to take care of three younger siblings in the middle of the Depression. But she was determined that others would not face the hardships that she had, or if they faced them, she would help them in some way. So she became a dedicated volunteer, philanthropist, and really taught me that the gifts you give from the heart are returned thousands of times over. Mother also had something that used to bother me when she said it, because I had to pay attention to it, and that was, to thine own self be true. And again and again, whenever I was on the border of something I probably shouldn't be doing, my mother's voice would ring in my ear, to thine own self be true. And I had to realize it. Central to my constellation was my extraordinary sister, Diane Dawson. Diane Dawson was a brilliant and tempestuous musical prodigy, and very daunting to be her sister, since she was performing with symphonies at age 11, and I was the one that didn't play piano. She was remarkable, and she was also a practical, rock-solid, honest, practical, fabulous teacher, mother, and friend. And my other central star is my husband, Rex Thompson, whose moral compass is the most unerring I have ever known, who is the most scrupulously honest and ethical man ever born, and he's also a creative genius. And that has made the 15 years of our life together one grand adventure. We have three children we share in our family, Diane the healer, Stephen the protector, and Dylan the kind. And so among us, that is our family, and that's my constellation. So if you kind of, now everything I'm going to tell you from here on out kind of refers back to that group of amazing individuals and the values that they imbued this woman with. So I'm going to give you two or three little stories at points where I had to like summon those values and try to make some sense of them. And the first ones happened when I was 17 years old. And it was at the Racial Justice Conference, and there were six racial justice conferences produced by the YWCA around the country in the auspicious year of 1969. And if you remember, that was a little volatile time at that point in life. And I had been elected by my YWCA in Corpus Christi, Texas, to represent my community at this racial justice conference. I was blown away. And it was being led by Dorothy Height, one of the greatest civil rights leaders ever, and should be recognized much more than she is. And so since I was representing my hometown, Corpus Christi at the time was 51% Latino and 9% African-American. So when the conversation arose that we should be talking about black justice instead of racial justice, I raised my little spindly hand and said, I don't think so. I think we need to be talking about racial justice, because who I represent is let's have racial justice for all. I had some very scary women get in my face. Who were saying, "Why? What do you think you know about it?" And I said, "You know, I don't know everything about it, but what I do know is that I am here to stand for racial justice." And interestingly, who stood alongside of me? Miss Dorothy Height. That was a profound moment, and it was like, stand your ground. If you know you're speaking the truth, speak the truth, and do it if you can. The next point in my journey came some 10 years later. And I took my first job in Dallas, and it was at a venerable institution, unnamed, which represents business interests, unnamed. And this institution was a great institution. I was one of only two women in senior leadership at the time, and I was the only one with P&L responsibility. So the first challenge ethically that came my way was my results were always reported out by the COO to whom I reported. And so I would turn in my financial results, and then he would in turn report them to the board. So the results that I had delivered to him were not what was reported to the board. In fact, they were vastly different. And so I went to him after the board meeting and said, "What is that about?" And he said, "Well, it's really for the best of the organization. In other words, my profits were going to make somebody else look better." And I just couldn't quite handle it. So I thought about it for a couple of days, and I thought, you know, I can't tolerate being lied about, nor that the board's being lied about. And so at the ripe age of 26 or 27, I call the board of chair and I say, "I got to talk to you." And I thought, well, this is a risk that's going to maybe lose you your job. It may lose you some things that you know you would like to have, but really you just have to do it. Fortunately, the board chair, who was an astonishing man, did what was right, made the right call, and I got to keep my job. I thought that was the right call, too. But a couple of years passed, and I have a new boss. And within a short time of his arrival, he began a very unsubtle affair with his married assistant. He was married, she was married. And, you know, everybody in the office snickered about it, and everybody kind of knew about it, and it was just kind of icky beyond words, and, you know, it was just there. And I was losing a lot of respect for this guy because I just thought this was not the way to behave in business. And but I still ran a department that produced a pretty good amount of revenue. So one day he comes to me and says, going to take a little bit of budget out of your budget to take my assistant and I are going to go overseas. And I didn't even take 2 days to think about that. I just said no. And so at that point, he called me in and said he would like my resignation. And I said, well, no, you're firing me, right? Right? I mean, this is what this is. And he goes, well, yeah. And I said, well, then why would I give you my resignation? So I didn't. I just said, no, I'm not going to submit a resignation. You fired me. I'm leaving. I'm going to go tell my staff, and I'm gone. And, you know, it was the best thing that ever happened because, in fact, it cut me loose to go do some amazing things. And I won't talk about the phone call I got later when he got that, but it does come around. But it was kind of wonderful because it sort of freed me to say, you know, just if you're going to take the risk, be willing to take whatever the result is. And the result turned out very profoundly good for me. And I got a great job with a great agency, and it prepared me for setting up my own business, which now brings us up to 1986. And that was the year of my real leap of faith, like plummeting off the cliff leap of faith. 1986, I was a single mom, or soon-to-be single mom, with a one-year-old son, a two-year-old daughter, the failing marriage. So I did what any brilliant woman would do. I started a business. And, you know, it was the 86, it was the S&L crisis, it was the real estate had gone to heck in a handbasket. I said that for you. And money was tight and everything was gloomy and wretched. And I thought, you know, let's do it. All my constellation is saying go for it. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. The risk will be worth it in the long run. And you can build a business on the precepts of honesty and teamwork that you hold dear. And so you don't have to work for the agency where you go, oh, PU, I don't want to work on that account. Or, oh, why are you lying to your constituents? No, let's try to do it the way you want to do it and try to do it honestly. So I took the leap, and I found some other fabulous people to leap with me, and we got some amazing, miraculous opportunities that came our way. I kept remembering, though, my dad's statement about trust and the fact that every day you have to earn the trust of the men who fight with you, you have to earn the trust of the people who walk with you. And I thought that's got to be where we start, is earning the trust of the people I work with, earning the trust of our clients and the community. So that's what we tried to build. And over the years, that meant we had to walk away from some business that would be called, in the nice way, morally repugnant. Business that just wasn't going to be right, and it wasn't right for us to do it. And so rather than putting a super spin on it, we walked away from a dishonest developer and resigned his account. We refused to take on the business of a restaurateur who was known for his abusive labor practices, and we refused to work for an absolutely egregious polluter. Sometimes it was hard because at the time, you know, you've got little children needing feeding and you've got your staff needing feeding and, you know, you sort of go, oh, man, you know, saying no is hard, but you sort of just knew it was the right thing to do. So our years of business passed happily and fruitfully, thank you, but there is a moment all of us face when you wonder whether you're spending your time being busy or spending your time creating meaning. And I will admit, and my husband will attest, that I was the queen of busy in business. 6 days a week, 7 days a week, no boundaries at all of what was, you know, the time that I would spend to do this work. And that doesn't necessarily bring you to a sense of meaning. And I continued to do that even when my husband was brought back from nearly dying from a full body burn in 1999, and as he recovered, he said, I'm going to live each day differently. I'm going to live each day like only someone who has almost lost all their days can live. And even with the example of him, living with him and loving him, I still was, you know, maybe I potted it down to 80% from 100%, but I was still on that busy wheel. And so then, as I'm moving toward 25 years in business, I think, what's the last part of my career going to look like? What will I have accomplished beyond a wonderful marriage, wonderful children? What kind of legacy is mine? And in those rare quiet moments, I was really struggling, trying to see what the future was really going to look like, more than getting on a plane on Sunday night, coming home on Wednesday night, plugged in 24/7, and just running hard. So I had a fantasy, and the fantasy was that the last 10 years or so of my career, I would be able to do something that really counted, that was meaningful, that was important that did something for others. And secretly, I wanted to run Dallas Women's Foundation. I loved it. I wanted it. But, you know, that was really a fantasy because Becky Sykes, my great good friend, was not that much older than I, you know. So I thought chances of her leaving and my ever having this opportunity are slim to none. But never say never. So now it's fall 2010, and I'm sitting on the board as chair-elect. And Becky announces her retirement. Oh, my goodness. You know, key point in my spiritual journey was this. Do you have what it takes? Do you have what it takes to really put your dreams on the line? And do you have the courage to take the risk now at 59, or 58, whatever I was, when you might not get it? And if you don't get it, are you going to be happy? So I was struggling on this one. Every time I got on a plane, every time I was in a hotel room by myself, I was struggling, thinking, can I really do this? Do I really have the courage to do it? And honestly, I didn't know, and I didn't know until the unspeakable happened when my sister dropped dead at the age of 59. And she was my eternal. She was my eternal. And I was sitting at her service, looking at her fine sons and all the students that she had taught all the years and their children who she was now teaching and all of her students from Mexico and my family, and I saw my sister's living legacy in that church. And I kept saying to myself, and what in the world is yours? So then it was just like my sister said it out loud. She said, go get it. Go find it. Go put it all on the line and take the risk you know you want to take, because maybe you can have the dreams you want to make. So with Rex at my back, the kids at my back, Constellation wrapped around me, I threw my hat in the ring, and lo and behold, they said I could do it. So now I'm on this part of my journey that I love. And I've got a great privilege and blessing to get to do the work that I do every day for the women that mean so much to me personally, the causes that mean so much to me personally, and the changes of life that we can do every day doing this work. So my point in my story really is not here's what I did, but more here's how you can have a constellation around you. You can have those people, those ideas, those wonderful supports that give you the foundation to draw on, the courage and the encouragement to do it, and to explore paths you would never explore otherwise. And so I hope this story encourages you to look at your own and think about how your journey's been influenced so far, where you want your journey to lead, and trust me, it can lead you straight to your dreams. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rosalyn. It's a privilege to be working with you here. I'm thankful to you and for your inspiration and to other people at Perkins, Connie Nelson and Dorothy Botnick and their offices who set this up. And, of course, to Maria and Steve, is it Kel? Is that right? And to Greg Hext for supporting us in our lunch today. And of course, always to Dodie Crockett, who got this going. It's her vision has initiated many things, including this, and I'm grateful for that. And of course, I'm especially thankful for Rosalyn for this time, and it's been a pleasure. We've met a couple of times. It's been a pleasure to get to know her and something about her vision. This semester, I've been teaching a new course that I designed in the fall, and it's about spiritual autobiography. And we're reading Thomas Merton and Anne Lamott and Kathleen Norris and Martin Luther King's mentor, Howard Thurman. And the students and I are reading these texts together, and we're also writing spiritual autobiographies at the same time. And so I've been thinking about this a lot, and I've also, over this semester, but especially in the last month and especially this last weekend, have been listening to these faith and business talks. Now, I have to say, these are very powerful talks. I had gone to Arkansas this weekend to see my father for Easter, and my two teenage daughters are with me, 13 and 15, and I thought we were going to talk and bond over the five-hour drive there, but I discovered they wanted to have their headphones on and listen to their own music, so I had a chance to listen to 10 hours of these faith and business lectures. And I am thankful for these lectures for many things, or these presentations and lunches, but one of the big ones I'm grateful for is they saved me from listening to my teenage daughter's music for 10 hours. But one of the things that struck me was the similarity of many of these talks, including Rosalind's, to these spiritual autobiographies. So, you know, when you and I met last time, Rosalind, and I had she had a draft there, and I was looking at it, and I thought, oh my gosh, this looks a lot like the things that we're reading in our classes. And I have a sheet I'll refer to that I put in your chairs that I'll refer to in a minute. But there are a number of similarities, and I wanted to say a few things about them. One is I found in almost all of these faith and business presentations that almost everybody says something at the beginning about fear or intimidation. Now, some of them say, I'm intimidated by the Perkins faculty, which I just can't get because I know the Perkins faculty, so I don't know, it's a familiarity or something like that. And I have to say, don't tell my colleagues this, but almost in every case, it's the business leader's talk that's the most compelling. But I never said that. Leave this room. And of course, that's not a great setup for my own talk, of course. But in any case, people said it was intimidating and scary. In fact, Maureen Dickey, who's was a city council person when she came and spoke here, she said she could easily talk about high speed trains and prostitution. But getting up and talking about her faith and her business was a hard thing to do. Many people talked about that. I think part of the issue, I think, is that this is simply a hard thing to do. It's a hard genre. If you look at this sheet, Frederick Buechner, I've got a quote there beginning, one of the deep springs of the autobiographical impulse is the effort not just to tell about yourself, but to become yourself. I think what happens, I mean, and this isn't even an impulse, right? They're invited by somebody to do this, and they agree, partly perhaps out of a sense of duty, and suddenly they're in this place of writing these talks. And it's not simply a matter of narrating a story. It's about discovering something about your own life. And it's also something very personal. I know Mort Meyerson and a number of others talked about how personal of a thing it is to talk about. So that's one of the things. The first Faith in Business talk was by Don Williams, and he talked about compared himself to the darkling thrush in a Thomas Hardy poem. So the poem shows this man, he's viewing a winter landscape, it's desolate, it's barren, and suddenly he hears this vibrant, beautiful voice of a brown thrush, and as Hardy says, flinging his soul in the growing gloom. So that's what Don Williams said he was doing. He says, I'm like Hardy's thrush, flinging my soul in the growing gloom. I think that's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do to try to tell something about your own soul. And I am so grateful for Rosalind and also for so many of business leaders in Dallas who have spoken about their own lives and about themselves and have helped me understand something about my own life in a different way for having had the benefit of learning from them. If you just look at the beginning of this this text, I'm just going to refer to it a few times, this handout I have for you. Charles Wood, who you may know, was for many years a professor here. He describes theology as a way of paying attention to God and everything else in its God-relatedness. Paying attention to God and everything else as it relates to God. And spiritual autobiography, then, is a way of paying attention to God within all the events of our lives, or paying attention to our lives in their God-relatedness. And I'll say here, you can think about God in different ways here. A lot of the talks are explicitly Christian. Some of the talks are explicitly Jewish, like Mort Meyerson's. You could think of a spiritual power or a lure or that which is of ultimate value, and you talked about values themselves as playing the central place. But again, when you do this, it's not simply a matter of narrating events. It's a matter of really drawing on and discovering something about your own self, and I really think discovering in some ways the divine tracks in your own life. What has God been doing in my own life? And I see this in these spiritual autobiographies that I read. How has God been acting in this person's life? One of the things that you find in these spiritual autobiographies, and I saw certainly in Rosalind's, is that there are these directional metaphors. There's a book by David Lee called Circuitous Journeys. And what he says is that a lot of narratives like this, spiritual autobiographies, these kinds of talks, they have a circular theme that was found in Augustine, in Augustine's Confessions. And they tend to start off at one place, and there's a horseshoe pattern, right? And they tend to start off at themes and things that came up even from childhood and young adulthood. And they start off in a direction, and at some point there's a turn, and they end up back somewhere similar, but not the same place at all. Does that make sense to you in your own life? But a sort of horseshoe pattern. And in fact, I know in this book by David Lee, he quotes, as a lot of people in spiritual autobiography do, that that T.S. Eliot poem, where we arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. It seems to me that's an experience that a lot of people have in recovering something from their own traditions. Rosalind refers to a children's book called North Star, and I raised my hand that I had read it, but I just read it like yesterday. My children, it's too late. I mean, they would be insulted if I read it to them now, so I'll have to wait for grandchildren, I suppose. But it's a great story about a boy on a journey, and he starts off just sort of being aware of his surroundings, paying attention, enjoying what's around him, and there's this cat. I'm a cat lover, so I'm not sure the cat it plays a bad role in this book. But in any case, so there's this cat that kept saying to the little boy, hurry up, you're getting behind. There's a path here, and you need to get on it. Behind? Are there other people? Yeah, there are other people, and they're ahead of you. Get on the path, get busy, get to work. And so the little boy does. And as he goes along the path, he suddenly finds himself in a place he didn't really expect to be. And you can see this dawning on him over a couple of pages, right? He's suddenly realizing he gets to a place and there's nothing wrong with this place. It's just not really the place for him. And then he begins to pay attention to his own constellation. Is it a cat or a bird? Someone points out the constellation to him. And he begins to look for these lights in his own life, for his own North Star, his own dreams, for these parts of a constellation that are his own heritage, the people, as you interpreted it, who've had an effect on him. And that leads him to a different place. You often find these, and I certainly saw this, Rosalind, in your story too, this constellation of people, these constellation of events, these constellation of values, these constellation of faith claims that come from our own heritage, our own traditions, that are a part of either keeping us on a path or when we get off, bringing us back to the path we know we need to be on. One of the things that I found moving in many of these talks, and including in Rosalind's, was this identification of people who matter to us. That is so, so important. Whether it was Mort Meyerson talking about his grandparents who had immigrated to the United States and moved west, whether it was Rosalind talking about her Southern Baptist grandfather in Waco who, you know, spoke out for social justice in the context of his own tradition, whatever these were, it's a very powerful thing. And I have some questions here, things to consider as you look. Because I really think that anybody can do this kind of reflection. And I think, in fact, it's probably something that we all do naturally, right, at some level. We may not write it down, but I think a lot of us in our quiet moments, maybe when something happens in our life, we think, okay, wait a minute, how did I get to this place, right? And what did I get? What would my grandfather say in this situation? What might my mother, my blessed mother, say in this situation, right? This is something we do. We look for those constellations. We look for those stars. So people, family, but not just family. You talked about Dorothy, is it Hyde? Dorothy Hyde. Other people talked about mentors in the business world or professors of theirs or Sunday school teachers. A heritage. I think you may be more influenced by your social activist Baptist heritage, you know? I mean, that may, I know you're not wanting to talk specifically about the Baptist part, but I think that's a shaping piece of who you are. Or certainly Mort Meyerson, when he talks about not only his grandparents, but also when he talks about the way he's been shaped by his study of Talmud, right? By his study of the learning of the Jewish people. All of these things come in to shape us. And also the values, identifying those key moral claims like honesty, right? And also this dream. And I think this book that you refer to, Rosalind, North Star, in your own talk, assumes that there's this sort of, that at some level many of us know internally, right? At some level we know somehow what it is that God is calling us to do or where we feel led to go. And part of our life is about discovering that. And what's odd about that journey is sometimes it takes us back in that horseshoe sort of shape, right? Where we end up back closer to where we began than we might have expected. Often in these stories, and certainly in Rosalind, there's a turning point. Now, in the boy in this North Star book, the turning point for him was when he realized, whoa, this is not really where I want to be, right? I've had those moments in my life, right? I'm going along full speed, and suddenly I look up and I think, oh, there's nothing wrong with this place to be, right? This is fine. I'm not doing anything terrible. It's all good, right? Or maybe it's not quite all good. Because I realize, oh, this is not exactly what I, this is not what's mine to do. This is not what I feel called. to do. So often there's some turning point. The first of these talks was given by Don Williams, and he tells of this story. Some of you remember, he's been on this three-week Middle Eastern tour getting business and very involved. It involves wars and planes, changing planes, etc., and he ends up at JFK, and he's running, trying to make his flight, and he falls flat on his face, and he bloodies himself up. Not bad enough to call the ambulance, but bad to sit there and miss his plane, right? So he sits there on the ground, and he thinks, Don, what on earth are you doing with your life? I bet a lot of us have those kinds of moments, and if you haven't had them now, you probably will. What on earth? And maybe you won't have to be bloodied and sitting on the airport walkway. But something happens. And it's not even that you're in a bad place. It's just you think, wait a minute, is this what's mine to do? Is this the way I want to spend these years that are left to me? Often these things happen, these turning points, whether in the spiritual autobiographies or in the text for this week, come when there's some crisis, right? Sometimes it's just a fall in an airplane, not to minimize that. Sometimes it's a moment of realization, but sometimes it happens with a crisis. You talked about Rex's, the burns in the period of crisis, and your own sister's death. So as you had told me and you told us together, there you are sitting in your beloved sister's funeral, and you think, Roslyn, what is your legacy? Have y'all been there? I've been there. I'll be someplace and I'll think, oh, you know, Miles, I don't know about you, but, you know, Connie says I'm involved in a lot of Methodist politics. And I know some of you are involved in office politics or city politics or whatever. And I get very worked up about it, red in the face and angry. And I go home and I cuss and I stop and I get angry and I want to throw things, but I don't because I have a slight bit of self-restraint. But I, in Perkins politics, can you believe that theologians argue with each other? I get upset about Perkins politics too, believe it or not. Every now and then I'm in the middle of all this political uproar, and I think to myself, Miles, what are you doing? This is not what you're in this for. This is not what I expected. How did you get so invested in this particular issue? How did this happen? And I feel like that little boy who's led along by, you know, one thing after another along a trail, and maybe that's not exactly where I'm meant to be, or maybe I'm meant to be in that very place in a different way. I think losing a person, a job, having an accident, those are some of the things that can trigger these big turning points. I wrote a book about grief after my mother's death that you mentioned that came out in 2012. And my mother actually told me to write it on her deathbed, which is really a terrible thing to do because how can you refuse what your mother asked you to do? And she asked my brother to write a sermon, which I always thought was really unfair. A sermon, a book. So, oh well. So in any case, so I wrote this book. And one of the things that I did was just to read some about grief. And there's this really beautiful conversation between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. You know, they exchanged letters back and forth. When they were old men. So here they are retired, and they're writing back and forth to each other. And this is 1816, and Jefferson wrote to Adams, and he wondered, what's the purpose of grief? What's the purpose of grief? And he says, what's its role in the perfection of moral character? And then he writes, I've often wondered for what good the sensations of grief could be intended. What is the use of grief? And it leads to this discussion that they have about what happens in people's lives when they grieve deeply over a loss. And we know, right? I mean, most of us here have lost someone dear to us, someone that we care deeply about. And not only that, but we've lost dreams, we've lost businesses, we've lost a lot of things. And there is a period of grief that comes. And one of the things that Adams notices, he says, you know, when you think of all those portraits of great people that you saw in the government buildings. He says, one sees in those faces strong traits of pain. Those furrows were all plowed in the countenance by grief. Adams writes, why did those who had grieved deeply often make the best legislators and magistrates? That's an interesting thing, is it? What is it about grief? I think one of the things that grief does is it sends us to ask those deep questions about what is the meaning of my life? What is it that I'm doing with my life? What's my legacy going to be? And it allows us maybe to take some risks, right? When we remember our own mortality or the mortality of those we love, we're more able to take a risk, right? The risk that seemed really big the day before may not seem as big on the day when you see it in the light of our of all of our mortalities. So one of the things that Adam says toward the end of this this conversation is they talk about why grief, and Adam says, you know, we can't know that. We poor mortals, he says, have nothing to do with this trying to understand grief. All we can do is to fabricate all the good we can out of all the inevitable evils. We know this kind of loss that has come upon us. And I think part of our life and part of the lives, whether it's a business people, community leaders, even professors, okay, maybe not professors. Yeah, even professors, even pastors. I mean, I see different people of different occupations here. But part of what we do is we take these experiences of our life and we see how we can put them to good use and how we can put them to good use of others. And I think that's one of the things that I see in a lot of these talks is whatever people's line up, whether they're in public service, whether they're still in business, that at some point in this turning point, they begin to ask, how can I live for others? One of the early business faith and business talks talked about, Frederick Buechner said, there are three great searches of life: for a person to be, for others to love, and for work to do. And those are questions we all ask, right? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what our line of work is, what our business is. We ask for that. We search for a person to be, for others to love, and work to do. And I think for all of us, there come times in our lives, maybe you're there, maybe you will be in the future, maybe you have been in the past, but there come these moments when we have to make choices. And we may end up staying doing the same thing, right? So I'm a professor with tenure. I ask these big meaning questions, but chances are in 15 years, okay, 15 years I might be retired. In 10 years? No, I have young children. 15 years I'll still be working paying for those bills. But chances are in a decade, you come, I'll be back here, right? And I think that's true of a lot of folks who have done these faith and business talks. It isn't necessarily that they change their line of work, right? But they come to a point in their life when they think, what do I do with all of this? What do I do with this life that I have made? What do I do with my resources? What do I do with my time? What do I do with my money? And those kinds of choices, I think, facing those kind of choices, honestly, is what makes us human. There's this beautiful passage by Viktor Frankl that I'll close with. So you've got Viktor Frankl. He's talking about his time in a concentration camp, right? And he talks about just how everything's stripped away in a concentration camp, all of the ordinary things that make you human, you know, the relationships with family and work and all those things in some ways have been stripped away. And he writes this: we who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They offer significant proof that everything can be taken away from a man or a woman. Everything can be taken away but one thing, the last of the human freedoms to choose one attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. This, it seems to me, is the heart of what it means to be human. That wherever we are in our lives, we come to these moments, ordinary moments in every day, when we make a small decision, a big decision, or the big moments when we think about our lives as a whole. And we make these choices about what ways we're going to take. And really, in the end, this capacity to choose one's own way is what makes us human. And I think for people of faith, for those of us who live out of heritages, whether Jewish or Christian or whatever your heritage is, where we live our lives in relation to God, then these choices that we make are made in relationship to the God that we know that supports us and loves us and draws us on, friends, and draws us on to a work that is greater than anything that we can do. To a work that that will allow us to love others, that will allow us to transform the world in ways that we cannot imagine. I sit here and I look at y'all and I think of the power, and I mean this in good ways, not the power is bad. I mean this in good ways, the power in this room, right? I look around this room and some of you, and I know, and the extraordinary things that you do. Most of us would probably even recognize the things that we do manage to do, we manage to do because of the grace of God that makes it possible. And I hope, I know I remember every day that I have my dream, and I've got my North Star right, and I try to remember that constellation of people and values and events. But there is also, and I think you're referring to this as well, there is this power that undergirds all that we can do and that makes it possible for us to do and to engage with others in making things happen that are larger than we could ever ask or imagine. Amen.
Thank you.
Dorothy Botnick with Perkins. I have been, if my memory serves, to every one of these faith and business lunches. There has never been one that has not left me, uninspired or with nothing to think about. They are always some of the most inspiring lunches, hours that I have spent. And I've spent a lot of lunches and hours, I can tell you that. Rosalind and Rebecca have graciously consented to take questions. We don't have microphones in the room, so if you would project and if you all would repeat the question, that would be very helpful. And we do have some time, so thank you very much, ladies. Any questions?
Make them easy.
Yeah.
This really isn't a question, but I can't sit here and not acknowledge the powerful work that Rosalind does in this community as stepping into this CEO position of running the Women's Foundation, which is vastly, it's on a roll upwards. And the trickle-down effect and the outreach that they produce as a result of her hard work and her picking the great staff and volunteers is touching so many lives. I only know a little bit about one part of what she does, but we work together on programming for girls who are in need of help that are in traffic. And that's one slice of what she does. But it takes really someone who has rolled in all of her knowledge and this constellation of people around you, but also how do you manage something that's as complicated, complex, and has so many different parts of it, and she does that with great finesse. So
you honor me.
Thank you for your message.
Would you say something about your work, Rosalind, that you had put some of that in one of the drafts?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for the setup, Karen. No, Dallas Women's Foundation really is. It's an extraordinary organization. You heard that there are like 165 women's funds globally, but it is a testament to the power of women and men in Dallas that the Dallas Women's Foundation is the largest of all of those. And so the belief in this community that investment in women and advancing women and girls truly does create that ripple effect that changes our community, makes it better in every way. So you see us working across a wide dimension of issues, areas. As Karen mentioned, we were privileged to get to work with her on the building of the Letot Girls Residential Treatment Center, which is going to provide long-term residential treatment for girls who have been trafficked between the ages of 13 and 17. And on any given night in Dallas, Texas, about 400 girls ages 13 to 17 are trafficked actively. And that's just really kind of the tip of the iceberg. So a huge problem that Karen has led in for many years, Generation 1 and Generation 2 and Generation 3 of Letot, and caring for these girls and really finding a way to change their lives in a truly dramatic fashion that you cannot do by putting someone into something for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and then pushing them back out on the street. So it's amazing work and amazingly needed. We work a lot now in women's economic security because women wear the face of poverty in our community just like they do everywhere in the world. And so let me give you a horrifying statistic. 30% of all the households in our region, across the whole North Texas region, 30% of all households in the region are female-headed. But 52% of all the households in poverty are female-headed.
So it's as true here as it is everywhere. And so we feel compelled to take much more long-term, deliberate 10 years. You know, my 10 years here is that we're going to make a real dent in women's economic stability. And another piece is around women's leadership, that we are still bumping up against that 17% ceiling, whether it's in Congress or any other place. And, of course, if you look around our community, we are just like everywhere else in the country, that 50% of the population isn't having voice where the decisions are being made, and we need to take a stand around that. We've worked extensively in health care, domestic violence prevention and safety, and all those issues that affect not just women, but the children that they depend on and the men in their lives. And so it is a blessing to do this work, and I know how lucky I am. So.
I want to say one of my students, I had heard about Dallas Women's Foundation, but one of my students, a PhD student here, is doing her dissertation on single female head of households. How would you say that?
You did great.
Whatever. You know what I mean. Whatever. And she put together several groups of women who were in Habitat for Humanity houses and had a series of interviews with them by different ethnic backgrounds and then all together. And it was transformative for her, and it's a part of her dissertation work. But one of the great things about it is the women begin to think, how can we become advocates for other women in similar positions? So there was this, it was a great learning opportunity for her, and I know she has told me so much about what you do, and I'm very grateful for y'all's work. It's impressive.
Can I brag on one of our grantees who's here? Can I brag on y'all?
I'm going to brag on y'all. One of the great things that the foundation has done is been able to invest in agencies that were just emerging and to take a risk. You heard that word before. But to take a risk on doing the right thing, even when the agency didn't have a long-term track record. And one of the huge opportunities that we had many years ago now was to help the formation of the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. And two of our wonderful friends from Texas Muslim Women's Foundation, y'all stand, are here. And this is... There you are. But this is a great story of the power of women coming together. The first and only culturally sensitive domestic violence shelter for Muslim women was built by the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation in Richardson, Texas. So a real cutting edge, real on the front edge of reality. And when they came to the foundation, it was, you know, we were excited to be able to solve a problem that had not been addressed in the community. But more excited than that, we were able to partner with these folks for close on 8, 9, 10 years now, and with so much joy in the growth of this organization, the power of what they've been able to do. So it really isn't just about what we do, but it's about what all of us are able to do together, and that's the statement about the foundation. It's what all of us can do together.
That's that Baptist minister thing. You hear it coming out. I know you do.
Rena.
Rena had her hand up.
Okay, go for it. Go for it.
I'm shorter.
I don't know about that.
Besides North Star, what is something that you've read or are reading that theologically is very important to you right now, really spoke to you, that you
so
would recommend to a friend?
Both of you.
What are you reading now that really resonated with you, or that is your standby that you recommend?
Mine's not very theological, but it's very meaningful to me. I return again and again to William Butler Yeats. You know, behind this facade of someone who was in PR for all these years, I was basically an English major. And drew a lot of my sensibilities from trying to live your life where you could be appreciated by that one lone fisherman on the Irish coast. You know, that there had to be certain truth in what you were doing, and trying to keep that kind of light in my head. So I would say less purely theological and more philosophical.
Just a couple of things. If you look at the bottom of the bottom of that sheet I gave you, there's some readings on spiritual autobiography that I think are really good. So there's that Pilgrim Souls. It's a collection, and it's a bit, you know, like any collection, it's a bit scattered, but that's a lovely introduction to spiritual autobiography. A book that I almost put on that list was Marilyn Robinson's Gilead. Some of you won the Pulitzer Prize. Beautiful book, and in some ways the best book of theology, just about the best book of theology I've ever read. It's the story, it's about an older congregational pastor who's writing to his son, and a young son, and he's an older pastor, and he's dying. And you can tell Marilyn Robinson has theological training. I don't know exactly where, but it's a beautiful book. So those would be a couple. I mean, I could keep going if you want to know, because this is sort of what I do. What I do for a living.
Other question, Catherine.
So I was struck by the fact that you both talked about grief. Roz, you didn't talk about it as a category, but your own experience of grief around your sister's death, and Becca, you talked about it a little more categorically. And I am interested in how our culture shies away from really talking about grief in honest ways. We talk about getting through grief and those kinds of things, but not really exploring grief. I admit that one of the most powerful afternoons of my life was spent in a group where we explored our own grief histories. And it was incredibly profound to do that. I'm just curious as to how much you've kind of stayed in that grief exploration mode, or have you kind of gone through it?
So I'm going to go first, and you may go, or whatever. Okay, so I did this book on grief because my mother told me to, and also because she knew what she was doing and knew I needed something to do, right, with the grief. And one of the interesting things for me is there's been a lot of research on grief. You know, I talked about Adams and Jefferson both having this discussion. Why is it that so many leaders, I think of bishops of the church, a lot of the bishops of the United Methodist Church have had terrible, terrible traumas in their life. A lot of leaders in the country have had difficult, difficult parts of their lives. And there's something that happens in grief where people can make a kind of, it can allow them to take risks because something happens to their fear, I think. Who knows why? But it seems to me that there is, it's an extraordinary opportunity. But what that means is you've got to deal with it and you've got to face it. And we're in a culture that doesn't, a part of our culture tells us not to deal with stuff that hurts, right? And grief is just unbearably painful. And it's not just our, you know, when you look at groups with a lot of people who've grieved deeply, it's not just our leaders, right? It's also people in prisons, right? It's people in, my husband was many years worked as a chaplain in an addiction treatment hospital. And you look at places where people have hit rock bottom, a lot of times it's because they haven't dealt with grief, with things that have come up. So it really presents, I think, extraordinary opportunities for people. One of the things, there's a study from a fellow out of Memphis, Tennessee. I don't know if he's worked at St. Jude's or not, but he's done some work on families who've lost children and then on families who've lost other people. And what they found is that the families, the parents that do something with their grief, the spouses that do something with their grief, actually have better outcomes. That is, if they find a cause, you know, if the child died of some rare or something, if they raise money for that, or if they take on a work or a cause that mattered to their deceased spouse or child or whoever it is, but that putting grief to some moral use, making sense of it theologically, was actually good for people. Does that make sense to you? It actually helped them. And I know you can't tell people who've just lost somebody, oh, now you need to go do something with your grief because, you know, they're not there yet, right? I mean, and you know, this is probably why I'm not in pastoral care, because I'd be tempted to do that. But you can't do that, right? But it seems to me at some point, right, at some point in your life when you've experienced loss, or if someone you love has experienced loss, how do you help them make that transition? And I think that's a huge task for all of us, right? I mean, we all have people that we care about who've lost. We've all, it's a universal human task. Is that an answer? Do you have a follow-up?
I just am gets really interested in the subject, and
yeah.
And I don't think people feel. And what I found was that the deepest griefs went back to old things, and they kept showing back up again. So it was like your bell curve, kind of like this, it just kept repeating.
Yeah.
Kept touching those, the touch point. It's been very helpful in my own life.
Yeah. You know, I'll get you a copy of my book, because I did that first chapter. I talk about different changing models of grief. So one of the things that I didn't know about is that I'll stop talking in a second. Not quite yet. The dual process model. So, you know, you used to tell people, you know, not to shut your grief down, go ahead and deal with it all. One of the things they say now is actually what's healthy is to do a little of both, right? To deal with the grief and then go do something else to change your mind. So I worried about my dad when my mother died because he was always saying, I'm fine, I'm going to go do something else, whatever. And it turns out that older men who lose their spouses, denial is one of their actual coping mechanisms. So, and it's healthy as long as it's not all the time, right? And another thing that's changed in, and I'll do this point and then I'll stop, I promise, is a different understanding of your relationship to the dead. So we used to talk about letting go, about getting moving beyond, and what they talk about now is renegotiating a new relationship with the person who's died. And, you know, like half of people who've lost their spouses have some extraordinary experience where they feel the presence of their spouse. Either they see them, or they hear their voice, or they smell their perfume, or they have a dream that doesn't feel like a dream. That's a lot. 50%, that's a lot. Or you think you begin to take on their causes or their memory or something, but you figure out how to come up with a new relationship to the person who's deceased instead of, and it's obviously still a loss, but it's somewhat different. I don't know if you want to. But I have to say, I mean, I found your story of your, and we talked about it separately too, of your sister's death and how that was transformative. And Rex, the burn and all
too. Your sister.
I do.
Still talk to your sister?
Rex just said that. He said, you know, this is, I still do. I mean, I'll go out and I'll talk to my stars, you know, like, well, what's up? You know, and it sounds silly, but it's not. I mean, that part of the thing about the constellation analogy really works. You know, we both lost both of our parents. We've, you know, we're down to, it's, we're the two left standing with one sister, you know, and our kids. And we carry them with us all the time. I mean, they are always with us. And I do. I have lots of talks to my sister. She gives me good advice.
We have time for maybe one other question. Anyone? Okay, a few housekeeping items. Rosalind, as a small gift for and thank you for your time and your thoughts, Rebecca's book. So, and thank you very much.